And we are back here once again with another episode of the Iron Man Podcast, episode 425. It's going to be with Mr. Lunchbox Warren. What's up, man? How are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing good, sir. Doing pretty good. Excited.
Awesome. You have your Batman with a yellow symbol on there, actually, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, there was a debate today on Twitter about which suit is actually a little bit more intimidating if you were to be Batman, like, running around. It's like the one with the black bat on the chest or the one with the yellow, you know? It just depends. I would say if someone's walking around with a bat suit beating up criminals, I think anything would be intimidating.
Yeah, in yellow or black. I do like the Frank Miller black emblem suit, though. That was pretty intimidating. But the yellow one does have a special spot in my heart, too.
And we'll start here, like I did with a lot of the people that I bring on for one-on-ones the first time. How was your life growing up, actually?
Oh, I grew up in a small little town in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. It was like my graduating class in high school was like 42 kids. And we were one of the bigger classes. Yeah.
42. Oh, my 42. God.
This is a little tiny town. And the closest city where we could do like big grocery and big purchases was 25 miles away. So my first experience in comics was when I started getting these Nintendo Power magazines from back in the day. They started having those Mario Brother and Zelda comics in them. And that was kind of like my first experience with comics because we were such a small town. And then when I started going up to when my parents took me out grocery shopping, I would beeline straight to the magazine area of the grocery store where the spinner rack was. And that's where I discovered Uncanny X-Men with Joe Madd. And I started reading Spider-Man and whatever they, you know, every time they asked me what I wanted something, it's like, I want a comic. So yeah, it was kind of weird going to school where like I was one of the few like pop culture nerds. There was only like a couple of us. Mm-hmm. And so like everyone was kind of mixed when it came to like, you know, if you were, you could be into big into sports, but you're also hunting and you're also this, like we didn't really have too many just special groups of just one kind of, you know, high school stereotype. Everyone was kind of mixed around because we were so small. But yeah, that was just kind of growing up, living in the small town, experiencing all the pop culture stuff and whenever I could, comics or the sci-fi movies. I was a big fan of 90s action movies like Aliens, Terminator 1 and 2, big Predator fan, RoboCop. I love all of those. I still think RoboCop and Predator are two of the best movies ever made. I absolutely love
that first Predator movie. I recently watched it back in 2022 or 2021, and man, that's so good, actually. It's so well.
Oh, it does, and it's such a perfect example of how to do an action movie. You spend the first 20 minutes establishing how badass Dutch and his crew are. So then when the Predator does attack and he just starts taking them out, it's so much more impressive because you have that, you know, establishing your hero's strength, and then bam, he hits the main protagonist and it's just all over the place then. So yeah, it's a great, well put together film.
I also really liked about it was another underrated aspect of it was the fear that the Predator was already causing in that lady's mind. So she was already fucking flipping out.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Like, man, movies just hit so differently back then from like how they were trying to approach it from like a practical sense, because now everything's just, you know, mostly CGI and it's all green screen. Yeah. But, you know, the practical effects really, really stood out. Like the practical effects in that movie go so incredibly hard. If you just look back on it now compared to what obviously do now.
And it still holds up. Like, even though the CG stuff can get pretty crazy, it doesn't seem as impactful as having a practical effect in there. Even if it's just partially a practical effect, it works out better than all CG, in my opinion. So, especially like the old Terminators and stuff, there was a lot of practicals in that too.
Because you said you grew up and you read like Spider-Man, X-Men, so you're mostly a Marvel fan growing up, right?
I did like Batman, especially when I got older, But Batman was one of the only like DC characters I really got into. Most of the characters I loved were on the Marvel side until I discovered indies after I got out of high school and was in the Army. I discovered independent comics. And that was an eye-opening experience because I was so used to superheroes. And then you read something like Preacher or Eric Powell's The Goon or Hellboy, and you're just like, your mind's blown, like, oh, you can do this with comics? This is amazing, you know. But when growing up, it was all superhero stuff, mostly Marvel. I really liked the relatability of Stan Lee's characters and that universe.
You were around for Image, weren't you?
Yeah, I was around for Image.
Okay.
I was following Image pretty hard, and also when it turned it, well, also when the cliffhanger offshoot of Image that had Joe Mad, J. Scott Campbell, Carlos Baccio, and who was the other guy? He did Crimson, which I absolutely loved. But yeah, I was there for the Image breakaway.
God, Marvel's do you remember really like the impact of Image back in the day? Because I don't think there's been anything really like it.
Nothing
describe, like it. You know? Like people say Comicsgate, but that's not really been on that same level because this had like an actual impact on how people even viewed what they were getting in the mainstream. It was such a huge shocker to everybody that this would be happening at the time. There's documentaries about it. There's many stories, many articles written about it. It's just kind of feels like it was just like you had to be there to witness the impact of it, actually, you know?
Yeah. If you really want to, if you look at it, Marvel hasn't never recovered. When those guys broke away, Marvel stopped creating artist superstars. Like they didn't want their artists to be the rock stars like they were at that time period. And up until this day, they've just recently started allowing some big names to take over some series and stuff. And it was that's the kind of impact Image had, where the Marvel's like, we can't let these guys become rock stars because now they can make more money doing independently than we could ever pay them or want to pay them. So it had a massive effect on the industry, and it opened a lot of eyes too, like how powerful the indie market can be if you have an audience, you know?
Because the way I kind of had to learn like comics and everything, like the history of it, basically I remember there was a guy, I forget his name. He had to go into like the studios of Marvel and DC when it comes to like all these comic artists having a lot of problems. They had to basically say, hey, if you pay these guys really good, and you don't kind of like rub in their faces that you own these characters. Because the thing with Marvel and DC, but like when you have like editors involved and people that are above them, the sentiment is like, well, it doesn't really matter how good you create a story or a character or whatever. Like they're mine. You know, you are under my control. And it's like, even though that is true, and like those things are kind of like unspoken rules you just don't say to people. You know, they already get that. They understand that. It's a thing that no one's that stupid. Like people already know that going in. I should probably respect what has been done before. I should respect the company and all other stuff. And then they were like, well, if I'm not respected here and my work is just looked at it like some fucking, I don't know, conveyor belt, I'm gonna just leave. That's the kind of sentiment that I got, honestly, because no one should have to go in there and tell, hey, just pay the artist some good money, you know, and they'll be fine, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You shouldn't have to, but that without. You see it in all walks of life with those corporations. It's it's trying to consolidate enough, you know, as much profit as possible out of it, and that appreciation for people that help you get there. And with that was a lot of what was felt like at the core of that Image breakup.
Mm-hmm. Like even now with Jonathan Hickman, who they brought back for Marvel, you know, Marvel and DC needs to understand big name talent does sell a story and comics especially, because like it would be how like, I would attribute it to anyone that looks at stuff now. Like when you have like LeBron James and the Lakers, obviously like I don't think he's as good as Kobe or Michael Jordan, but he does have some really insane big name brand value. He will drive people to come and watch his game, you know.
Oh, instantly. And now
comics, you don't really have a lot of big mainstay people that are just willing to just work with the mainstream, because they've realized not only do you not make as much money, you're putting in all this work and all this effort. They still don't see you as valuable. You might as well just go do your own thing and make all the money for yourself. But then again, as you would know, that has its own layers of problems too, because they basically provide like the infrastructure and the financials. All you have to do is just basically essentially work for them. But then,
you're famous, it's got to be hard to self-market and draw and write and get all of that stuff together. So yeah, it's even for someone who has a huge following, it has to be a gigantic task to think about. Okay, well, it's a big risk, you know. It's like, I'm going to go out there. Well, I don't want to fall on my face. But at the same time, if you have a name there, I guarantee if Joe Mad decided to come back and do interiors and did a Kickstarter and was a, you know, he would probably pull easily six figures, first time out. But it's still intimidating to do that.
Because there's been cases where even though you've had like big name talent go out and do their own thing, hasn't worked out very well. I mean, Mark Waid's didn't work out very well at all. And he's also had some other shenanigans he tried pulling, but that didn't work out. There's a lot of them that tried doing their own thing and it just didn't pan out, obviously. So when it comes to comics, I've always looked at it like the audience kind of determines like who they want doing most of their stuff. Or you have to insanely impress on the first round, or you have to prove yourself over constant books and series over the years for them to like support. Because I think people have money. Because the thing with Kickstarter campaigns or Indiegogo campaigns that people haven't been noticing is, like, if there was no money in the scene, like, it's absolutely no money, no one would have money to fund people's books, right?
Yeah.
Because there is enough money to fund people's books and get them printed. The problem here is that people are super selective on who they give their money to. That's really what it is. They have money. It's just they're just being super selective on how they give the money out. You know, because people, if there were no money, then campaigns would be flopping really bad, actually.
There's a lot of people are just, they might be getting a little bit tighter with the money, but there's definitely still there. It's just there's a lot of landmines of crowdfunding that you got to be careful.
Lots of landmines, yeah.
are they going to fund? Are they going to get the book done? You know, there's all sorts of stuff. I just recently launched my campaign, and I was putting on there multiple times. I tell people, it's like the book is done. Ready to ship, all you know. So
you're just recouping back your investment, essentially.
I'm using it more like a storefront, but it's like, this book is done. I don't need the money to finish it. All the artists are paid, and I'm a writer artist, so I don't charge myself that much. But
he charged guys $6,000 for a cover for himself. I think when it comes to indie comics and stuff like that, I had to learn so much about how books are made. Cause like the way I thought books were made was not what happened. So if you understand, I could just DM you and just ask you how it's made. I could just do you, how's the process done? And even if I'm able to ask you that, everyone else's process is different because there's different artists everyone uses, actually different printers, like not even just the post office. You have to even hope the post office can get all the books out in a timely fashion so people can get their stuff. There's a lot that really goes into that. So yeah, you can make all the money for yourself, but like then again, you have to kind of factor in how much money gets even dispersed amongst artists, writers, interior artists, letterers. You know, there's all these many jobs that go into this actually. And guys, these people aren't cheap. Artists is not cheap. Okay, I can see why people hire people from Brazil or Australia or Europe. Actually, you know, because people understand. Do you know comics are like 20 per page? Well, you understand this. Understand to the audience. A floppy, it's like 24 pages for the average book, right? Okay, people, so 12 of those pages cost around, let's say, okay, 80 a page. Okay, so 80 times 12, there you go. That's just 12 pages. That's not even the full book, okay? Now, you do 80 times 12 on the rest of the pages. Yeah, that's a lot of money. Now, it all depends on what they charge and everything, but we're talking about the standard rate that goes, because Marvel and DC, from what I've heard, is 60 to 80 a page. Because that's a 24-page book. That's going to run you about at least $1,000-something and some change. $1,000 on pages alone.
Yeah. And if you're going to do a Kickstarter campaign and you throw in variant covers, and if you're doing all the hiring, it's anywhere from at the cheap end, $4,000, and the high end, you know, $6,000 to $10,000, depending on what kind of artist you're getting. Right. So right off the bat, if you're hiring all that art to work for you, you're instantly into this for $4,000. If you're going to do a Kickstarter, you just have to get to $4,000 to pay that bill.
Just that.
And then not counting getting the print runs, then all the shipping supplies, playing for the shipping and trying to factor in the shipping, even though it goes all over the place. And it's just, there's a lot of stuff. And, you know, when you're doing this also, you know, it's awareness. Like, I tell people, like, when you're talking about marketing and trying to build an audience, I go, imagine, like, walking 10 miles, but only traveling, like, one step of distance. That's what marketing really feels like at times. You're putting in hours and hours of work on the book, the pages. You know, a page can take me up to 8 hours from start to finish.
Yeah, sequential art takes a while to
do. Yeah, it is a grind. Sequential art. I can see why Joe Mad doesn't want to do it anymore and does video game design, because it is a pain in the rear, and I'm not even close to his level. But yeah, it's a lot of time to put in, and then you know you go to show it out, and then you're selling this product for like $5 to $10, you know.
Yeah, because all the money that you invested, so that's what I say to the audience is, you know, you see all these campaigns that are like 9K, 5K, 8K, and remember, these people have to be getting paid on the lowest end for that to even be possible. And then you're still selling the book for like potentially $10, $15, $20 maybe, actually, right?
Yeah.
And then people get on Kickstarter and Indiegogo. If you have a book that's valued at $25, that's going to be $10 in shipping. People just think it's just $25 flat. It's like, no, because I think there's another creator that had his book, he was advertising that was like $5. And I was like, okay, I know that's what your angle is, but when you go on that website and you hit that processing fee and the shipping, that shit's coming out. It's literally $10 flat. So that book is not $5. That's $15, actually.
Yeah.
You know? So it's one of those things where I can understand why people don't back indies, not because they maybe even feel like they don't get them. It's just more like, it's a lot of money investing. 25 each campaign, 20 each campaign. This is for a book you haven't even received yet. So if you do like three of these, that's $60, $80 just gone in books you haven't even gotten yet. You know, just from the audience point of view, I can understand it, you know?
Yeah. And if you're an audience person and you don't know the process, you're like, well, okay, well, why is it Marvel's book is $3.99 or $5.49?
I have to explain that to people so many times.
And you want me to pay $25 for yours.
Yeah.
And it's like,
the tagline for it, man, is my quality is better. And I'm like, people got to stop doing that, because if your tagline is like, my quality is better, then okay, by that logic, you could actually just buy any book way cheaper. And you, because quality, people are saying quality is a perceived thing. Quality is something that is a subjective perceived thing amongst the two of us or whoever's consuming the book, right? And for people who don't know, the reason why they can get those prices down, first of all, it's printing deals for the most part. And they have, it's like you have a car, you know, you go to your insurance company, you get insurance, and they essentially charge you a lot because you're a new driver. Okay, guys, for a new person, they would definitely have a harsher deal because they're new. It's how most of these companies like factor in and function. Marvel and DC have been doing this for so long with their printers. They have probably, man, deals where you can probably print a book for like less than a dollar, if we're being honest here. Less than a dollar, you know?
They're printing, you know, 10,000, 15,000 books on the low end.
They have so much money, you know, they can do the Ultimate Spider-Man number one is on its fifth printing. They have enough money to do 5 printings on a book. That's one single book. That's not like all the other titles that get multiple printings that potentially sell out. Someone like you, someone like me doing it, now we're getting the one print run, and hopefully this covers everything. Getting a second print run would require another campaign, doing a second chance campaign, actually. Because printing costs a lot of money, guys. Not just paying a lot of artists. Printing costs a lot.
I do. I have a 44-page black and white book, so it's cheaper for the black and white. Color adds more to the interior. If I do a 25-book print run, it's going to cost me $250 per book before I factor in shipping. So right there, instantly, just to get a book off, you know, out, printed and into a customer's hand, that's going to cost me $250 a piece. Then, if you're trying to ship, I do Gemini, bubble mailer, bag and board. I ship them really secure. That's another $3 right there of shipping material. Then you got to deal with rates of shipping. To ship one comic to Canada costs me $25 in shipping just by itself.
Yeah.
You know, it is. So there's so many costs in this. And it's like, once you break it down to somebody, they're like, oh, okay, now I understand why your book is $20 or is, you know, $15. But then before that, you know, it is a hard sell before that, though.
Yeah, because just getting the – and then we like you said before, getting people to actually buy the book is another task, because this is the conversation that I had on the Iron Man podcast when it came to movies recently. You know how like a lot of the super movies have been flopping? Specifically more like the DC side, because you know Marvel's just recently kind of going through that. DC has always functioned based off of like what they think people are going to pay money for versus what people are actually willing to pay money for. That's something that people need to understand. It's like a person could be like, yeah, I saw Booster Gold in an episode of Justice League animated series. I think a movie of his would do very well. Okay, so just with that concept alone, people, just because you think that is what people would want to pay for is very different than what they will actually pay money for.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Because the audience, you know, they got to get to determine that. What are they actually going to spend tangible money on, you know? And that, like we're seeing all these companies make all these decisions, and it's like, are people going to be paying money for that? Are people really interested in that shit? Like, we're gonna be, that's the reason why a lot of this stuff is flopping. It's not because it's even, like, bad. Oh, it's bad. But, like, it's no interest. I'm not interested, you know?
God, they're taking away all the freedom of their creators. Like, you hear about, you know, the Justice League movie. The reason why that fiasco even happened was because focus groups didn't like certain parts, and the executives were trying to copy Marvel's success. You can't do that in the middle of a film production where you just stop everything and just start changing parts. The rise of the Skywalker, the last of the new trilogy. Mm-hmm. That was another one that they had focus groups, and they were like, okay, this 15-minute scene, we don't like it, so let's change this. And then at the end of it, you're just, the audience watches it, like, this really feels like a movie that's been cut all to, you know, crap, and it doesn't flow anymore. And they really, that interference and that hurting of creativity and trying to, like you said, guess what the customer wants instead of listening to them, it ruined of both the DC and Marvel franchises, in my opinion.
You know, Grace Randolph, the crazy white lady, you know, she has some really horrible takes. And we're talking women shouldn't have opinion level takes. But she did have one take that I did really agree with. And a lot of DC fans did this a few years ago when the Zack Snyder fiasco was happening. It's like, she had mentioned, basically paraphrasing, you know, somewhat captioned my brain, was like, DC fans always do that, where someone will come out and they'll understand information about a project. They say they'll pay for it, and they never do. It happens a lot. The Rock thought he had them when he brought back Henry Cavill. Nope. Are people going to be paying money for a Black Adam movie? Solo Black Adam movie at that. It's like, no, it's not really what the audience wants, you know?
That film should have never had the JSA. That should have been the Shazam family. That film, him trying to separate him from Shazam was a huge, huge mistake, especially with the popularity of Shazam. And, you know, if you're trying to build something off that, it was just not handled well at all. And that's a lot on the Rock, from what I understand, too. So,
yeah, it's one of those things where when it comes to, like, superhero characters, like a character like Black Widow. Well, Black Widow, it's a character that's, like, arguably C-tier in some cases, D-tier maybe to a lot of people. Scarlett Johansson is the reason why Black Widow is popular, not Black Widow. So when they're making a Black Widow movie, because, you know, Kevin Feige was really pushing that with Ike Perlmutter saying, no, I don't want to do that. Black Widow finally came out, people. Now, to be fair, they did do a day and date release. They did kind of screw her. I understand that. But just the idea of a Black Widow movie, to me, I was always, I don't really care about that. A Black Widow movie? By yourself? Yeah. I'm okay. You know? It's like, are people really interested in that? Or are they more interested in Scarlett Johansson with her tits hanging out and her ass hanging out, playing Black Widow? That's the thing, you know?
I mean, I don't blame them if they are.
Oh, Lord. The thing with a lot of, like, Eternals had that. They try to copy the Guardians formula, unknown director to their fans, and random characters they literally never heard of, bunch of race swaps and gender swaps, completely flopped. Shang-Chi, people don't even know. If you're into a fighter in the Marvel Universe, you could just hit Iron Fist. Iron Fist is like the number one karate, you know, hand-to-hand fighter for them for a lot of their stories. Nope, they do Shang-Chi. That flops. You know? Like, it's just, all these decisions have just been so bad. I can understand why no one's been paying for these movies. And for people to say, well, the number at the box office for them have been kind of high. Well, a lot of that goes to the theaters. A lot of that goes to the international theaters you put your film into. Marketing and... a lot of the money they make is just nothing. They probably barely broke even on some of those. By barely broke even, I mean they make no money.
They have to make almost $800 to $900 million just to break even.
Not profit. Right, right.
Yeah, not profit. Yeah. And you know, they lost like what $30 billion in their last so many movies. It's just you know, that they had, where even if you look at pre-Endgame, like we have post-Endgame, pre-Endgame. If you look at pre-Endgame, it was James Gunn and the Russo brothers that essentially saved the Marvel MCU universe. When Winter Soldier came out, that was kind of like, I still think technically and story-wise, the best all-around film probably in the whole series. But it was their films that really put Marvel on a direction and kind of saved them when it, because there were some real stinkers happening. These two
started with Iron Man 3 and Thor the Dark World, and those are bad movies. Those are like awful. Yeah, they're not as bad as like what we're getting now, but they're still bad. I remember watching both of them in theaters. I watched them multiple times. They're not good, you know. And then Phase 2 had Ant-Man, which was good to me. You had Age of Ultron, which was pretty meh, you know.
That one could have been better, but it wasn't terrible. But yeah,
like, you know, and then Phase 3. I mean, so like Phase 3, it kind of picked up again. But you know, I told people, even with the MCU, like back then, people were willing to pay money for some of these movies, and now you have it at the point where the Marvels has made the lowest amount in all of them.
Oh yeah, Disney has lost the faith of the audience. Mm-hmm. Disney was a corporation that had probably the best faith with its audience, or trust with its audience, for like three generations of people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this just recently with the Star Wars debacle, the stuff that's been going on in, you know, with the behind the scenes, the Marvels, with what's going on with the Marvel properties, they've lost all faith. Like, I love X-Men 97. I think it's going in a good direction. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about Deadpool Wolverine, but I'm not watching anything else unless I hear a resounding deal, because I have lost faith. I don't even think Deadpool can save what's going on. You're going to have a couple congruently good films and good ideas to really get this back on track, because right now they've lost faith in the audience. Because
what I've heard, X-Men 87, I've heard it's been pretty good for a lot of people. I actually plan on watching the first episode to the one that's up right now, because on Friday we're going to do like one of those kind of before season finale discussions of it, because I really get into it. So it's one of these things where you have, it's crazy how the X-Men are saving the MCU right now. It's actually ridiculous. You have Deadpool and Wolverine coming out, and then the stuff coming out after is like so beyond non-interesting, where like the only way that stuff makes money, profit. They're lucky they break even, if at all. But you'd be lucky if you even went to the theaters to see it, unless the word of mouth is so stellar on these movies. We've already heard Captain America 4 has been going through many reshoots. You know, people haven't been liking it already.
That's never a good sign either, when they're changing.
Especially when you hear the test screening results of like people walking out and feeling it's boring. You know, Thunderbolts. You have, Thunderbolts, Captain America 4, Blade, Fantastic Four, even though they've already announced they're doing the female version of Silver Surfer. It's like, people are trying to make money, yet you still make decisions like this. Absolutely ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Good Lord.
All. Especially when you're dry. It's like, they do good, and then all of a sudden they just make some kind of weird change just because, you know?
that's what it feels like now for the MCU. It really feels like you're getting this big line of shit. One gem in there, big line of shit. One gem, big line of shit.
What's probably going to happen is Deadpool and Wolverine will be the first thing they've had profit on since Endgame, and they're just going to start shoving Ryan Reynolds in every single Marvel movie for the next 10 years. We're going to have just the Fantastic Four with Deadpool.
Yeah, because I remember we try to factor in what have people generally enjoyed, like just from word of mouth, since Endgame. The only two we came up with was like No Way Home and Guardians 3.
Yeah, so No Way Home was really, really good. Like the best Marvel stuff wasn't made by them.
I forgot that's Sony. Mostly they're involved with that. It was just their logos on it, so, you know.
With that and Into the Spider-Verse. Like, I really liked the Miles Morales.
Yeah, that really was good. Animated. Yeah, those two were
both
great.
Both of those
are
really good. Yeah, but you pretty much, that's it. I mean, those are the really ones that got a lot of good buzz. And they didn't really capitalize on it. I heard Madam Web was just terrible.
I saw a few scenes from it. I was like, nope, Yep. Yeah. Actually, you know what's great to do? I was surprised people were calling that trash. All of them have been trash. Every single one of those are bad.
Oh,
this,
yeah.
Now at this one, people are like, that first Venom movie is legitimately ass. That second one is ass.
I'm so glad someone else thinks that, because I hated both of those movies.
They're and bad. I have
like, no, they're a lot of fun. Like, no, they're just butchering the kid. No, that's terrible.
Morbius is like dog shit. I don't know why
I didn't even want to watch that one.
God. And now they're making they push Kraven back. I think Venom 3 comes out a few months before Kraven. It's like, can we stop that? Those movies right there are what contribute to superhero movie fatigue, though, that kind of universe.
Yeah.
They're legitimately never good. They've never, like, they're just not entertaining. They're just stupid. And they're boring. They're nonsensical. Like, I can see why people are tired of superhero movies if you're getting that. That's just trash.
I don't think it's fatigue as much as it is just faith. Like, no one thinks any of this stuff is going to be good. There's no buzz. There's no eagerness. I think once they get a rhythm, like, I'm really excited for the James Gunn DC movie verse. Mm-hmm. I'm a big James Gunn fan. I think DC needed to have a general in keeping creative in a direction. And I think they're in a place where the executives are kind of like, we're letting him do this and we're kind of, you know, make us money, James. And I think that could, if that Superman movie's good, it's going to be like $2 billion. And it's going to be this resurgence, because I don't think there's movie or superhero fatigue. I think it's just so many bad things that no one's even getting up anymore. Like, I'm not going to go spend $14 to go watch a movie at the theater if it's Kraven, because it's like, nah, I'll just wait till I can see that for free on the streaming, because it's not worth spending money to go that disappointed.
Because With James Gunn, I enjoyed Guardians 1. I feel like Guardians 2 was a little bit weaker compared to 1. I enjoyed the Suicide Squad. I really liked that one.
I love that movie.
That was such a blast, man. I can't believe people were shitting. I was like, okay, now people are proven they're not comic fans. The Suicide Squad people do not act like the Avengers. I know that's kind of confused people about how superhero groups work. These are a group of villains. They act like villains. They went in and shot up a group of people just for fun. That's what villains do. I was literally watching the criticism. I was like, bro, do you people even read? They don't read comics, to be honest. That doesn't happen. People are just literally saying shit like, well, they didn't act heroic. It's a group of villains.
Yeah, that was like watching an old Suicide Squad comic come to life. Like, I was like, he understands this property. He understands the characters.
The characters are supposed to be like, you know, you're kind of uneasy at them. They're supposed to give you that villain feeling. You don't know who's going to. That's always been in Suicide Squad comics.
Oh, yeah. And Peacekeeper. Did you get a chance to watch that?
Yeah. I like that show.
Oh, that was really so good. So
yeah, he did John Cena. Really good. Mm-hmm. so season two, hell yeah. Sign me up. I'll watch season two. I really enjoyed season one.
Yeah, that's what got me excited, because it's like James Gunn has a good understanding. Like, that's why with his Superman, some people have been shitting on it, but you do have a lot of Snyder bros, and those guys are pretty hardcore with Snyder, which is nothing wrong with it. I love different aspects of what Zack Snyder can do, but it's like James Gunn, he has an understanding of Superman that we're going to see the closest thing to Christopher Reeve's Superman, I think, probably since Christopher Reeve's Dawn the Cape, where it's like symbol of hope kind of Superman that was drastically, you know, tragically missing in the Snyder ones. Even though I thought Man of Steel was a good film, I just thought that they went too dark with Superman. He's supposed to be a bit more about hope than he was.
Yeah. Remember the criticism for Harley Quinn and James Gunn's Suicide Squad was like, oh my God, she just randomly killed that guy. I was like, people, do you know who Harley Quinn is? She's not a sane person.
Yeah, don't turn her into your role model there. She is a psychopathic serial killer. You know, it's like, don't get me wrong.
Like, people were like, how did the javelin go through Starro? People, that was a joke. The fact that we have people who explain jokes to people is ridiculous. It didn't do anything. The rats killed Starro. The javelin was just like, why is this crazy lady flying herself into the eye of a monster thinking the javelin's going to kill? It's like, no, it doesn't. She just looks like an idiot. That was the point. You're supposed to laugh. I agree. Like, the rat taking out Starro is pretty crazy because Starro's a Justice League villain, but the javelin literally did nothing. It's like,
yeah. What is it wrong was a good use of Starro, too. It stayed true to the core Starro, even though it was a Justice League villain. But
I like how he just like stomped on the dudes, like, this is your mom, who's just stomping on that dude. God, I remember watching the first time, I had an absolute blast with that. That to me, that's the second best movie in that universe. My personal favorite is the first Shazam movie that came out back in 2018. I really enjoyed that first one. The second one,
That first Shazam movie was really. That really felt like, you guys see, this is what happens when you leave a good director, a good team alone, and let them just make a movie. Mm-hmm. You get it up, you know, hitting it out of the ballpark. So that was a great one. And yeah, Suicide Squad was definitely one of my favorites. I have no love for the first one. I don't even care if there is a Snyder cut. I didn't like Batman v Superman. Yeah, I'm real excited for the new gun era. I don't know about Marvel if they're going to be able to pull it around. I mean, I imagine Deadpool and Wolverine is going to be good.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's going to translate to anything else unless they really kind of, you know, get some cohesion back and remember that they're making comic book movies. And I think it might help out. And Sony just needs to fire whoever's...
Sony just needs to stop.
Deciding all these spinoffs. Like, if you want a true spinoff, introduce the character in a Spider-Man movie and then spin it off from there.
Yeah.
Don't just randomly make one over here where your Tom Holland Spider-Man crew is not even talking to what the Venom people are doing and there's no cohesion. It's like DC tried to create what Marvel did without a Kevin Feige. It's like, no, you need a general. You need somebody, a captain. Yeah,
that's why you have a showrunner for TV shows. Like, there's someone that has a vision and a direction. And, you know, you talk to DC fans back then. You remember, man, you were online. These guys were like, well, I don't want DC turning into Marvel. Oh, you mean successful. Oh, God. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's how you know you're talking to some fucking weird communist. It's like, you would, guys, I know, like, you guys do these things for the love of things. Like, you watch it for the love, but you, at the end, you have to make money off this stuff. You just do. Because, like, there's a lot of things involved where you have to make money. It's just, I love how the DC fans are like, hey, we don't want to be like Marvel, yet all they would say in the talking at both sides of their mouth, but they want it to be like Marvel. It's like, what are we doing here? The conversations are stupid. You know, the conversations, I swear, were super insufferable with DC fans from like the Man of Steel period all the way up until when James Gunn took over, man. Just absolutely asinine takes about how stuff would work in the business model. It's like, yeah, I agree. They probably should have just let Zack Snyder finish his stuff and then fire him. But the reception from those movies were so unbelievably bad, I can understand why they stopped it. Because it's like, bro, this is just a dumpster fire. This is not worth the time, you know?
When your goal sheet says that you need to make, you know, $1.5 to $2 billion to be considered a success, and the film makes like $800 million, that is not a good day for them at all. Which is crazy to think that a movie can make $800 million and be a failure. Like, the first Deadpool cost, like, was it 50 or 30 million to make?
Yeah, makes 782. Crazy.
Yeah, and it's like, they love that stuff. You know, producers get all excited over that kind of stuff. But, yeah, it's a tough deal. And, you know, there was a lot. It's like, you don't have to go Marvel, but you need, if you're going to do DC, you need to do a Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman movie, the Trinity movie, and then do Justice League.
You know,
four films and you're at Justice League. You don't have to do what Marvel did where it's like, you know, like a whole bunch of films to get there. No, you introduce the main Trinity, and then from the Trinity you introduce Flash, Green Lantern, and then maybe save Cyborg for the Justice League film. And then bam, now you have your Justice League, you know. I feel bad for Zack Snyder because, like, when he was first brought on, he was brought on like a Kevin Feige, and he's like designing this 10-20 film arc. And then they're like, you know what? You just do movies and fit all of this in like four movies. And Zack Snyder is, I love him to death. He makes some of the most beautiful films. 300 is amazing. I love Watchmen. But that guy, if you give him a 2-hour time slot, he's going to make you a 6-hour film. And then you're going to have to try to cut that up to fit 2 hours. And it's just like, it never works, bro. Like,
yeah. And it's even worse when you think about it more logically, is that they saw what Zack Snyder was doing. They saw all the, you know, stuff, the storyboards he wrote out. If they truly didn't like his style, from based off the things that we've heard, they just go like, hey, dude, it's not working out. We got to move on. Let's go our separate ways. They saw everything he was doing and went, you know what? Man of Steel. Okay, it's 50-50. Let's do BVS. And it's like, that's when they decided to pull the trigger at when the movie was done. Because the thing is, they actually chose to pull the trigger right as Justice League was filming. Forget, Justice League was already filming when BVS came out and all that reception happened. Because he'd already worked for them. He'd already did Watchmen, another DC property. He had already did 300, Dawn of the Dead. He did a lot of stuff. So they've seen his work. It was just like, that's why I do blame them more than him for the most parts, because they saw his work. They saw it. And the Watchmen stuff is a little more easier because he just kind of put, you know, panels to screen. That's a little bit more easier than, you know, just creating a whole Batman and Superman story from scratch. And remember when they gave J.J. Abrams $50 million to do nothing? Oh, great decisions.
Yeah. Oh, that was awesome by them.
Yeah, great. He's like, I get $50 million and you get nothing.
They spent like $90 million filming the Batgirl movie and then they just banned it. Like, we're never going to get to see that.
Well, I wanted to ask you this, since you are a part of Indie Comics going into your book. So your book is called The Adventures of Sig and Joe, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yes, so sir. What was the conception of that?
I first drew the characters back when I got out of the army and I was in diesel mechanic school. The teacher, because I've been drawing my entire life, and the teacher would tell us, you know, drink coffee to get the sleep monsters from getting you when we were in the classroom. So every classroom I've ever been in, I've always done a lot of drawing. So I started drawing this coffee cup with arms and legs fighting these Z monsters. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward to about 7 years ago now, I decided, you know what, I want to make comics. I've loved comics my entire life. I've thought about doing it. I've wanted to do it at times, but I never pulled the trigger because it seemed like a huge mountain deal. Am I good enough? Can I do it? And then I pulled the trigger and I started developing these two characters that I've been drawing for years, this cigarette and coffee cup guy. Originally, I was planning to do a parody where it was going to be like making fun of pop culture stuff. But then I started to get, as I learned how to write, I started to get the writer like this bug. And I just started, you know what, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to throw everything I love at it and create something that I'm going to be really happy with. So I just started delving into, and I created this big, huge story arc. I'm a big fan of Firefly. I'm a big fan of Eric Powell's The Goon. Mm-hmm. And both of those series do this job of balancing between comedy, action, and then some drama, where Eric Powell's The Goon, one moment it's almost like they're fourth wall breaking and they're doing this funny ad, and then the next moment you're choking back tears because you found out about something about Goon's backstory, or they have a villain they face that's part of one arc, and that villain has like a sadder story. I love how even with Firefly there's times where they're just joking, where it's almost like this is a space comedy, and then the next moment they're into some serious thing where people and actions are real important. So I took the Sig and Joe and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to put them in the sci-fi world. They live on a little tiny moon called the Waste Can by the people that live there. It's essentially like a desert moon that has abundance of minerals and resources. So there's all of these like mining claims and stuff all around it, with the big city in its central point where there's a space elevator going up, the only way off the moon. And I started crafting the story, and it kind of became this whole Aqua Teen Hunger Force meets Firefly with some Mad Max and Blade Runner splashed in, throwing some stuff that I loved with I love the idea of artificial intelligence, AI, the ramifications of war. All of this stuff is sprinkled in this sort of goofy comedy comic where a punching cigarette and a cigarette sharpshooter are battling robots and biker gangs, evil corporations, and trying to save the innocence of the waste can. I already have issue one done. Issue two is completely done, except for on my Kickstarter, I offered a guest appearance, so I'm going to draw that in. Issue three is ready for grayscaling, and issue four is on paper. So like, I'm full steam ahead on creating this series out, and it's going to go on. That's just the first arc is the four, but I have a like four or five arcs planned out to this big crescendo finish that I'm going to be doing with this series.
Okay. And I'll ask you, what made you, like when you pulled the trigger, were you like initially like, man, there's a lot, like I talked earlier, there's a lot that I have to do. Did that like initially, how long did that deter you from even pulling the trigger, honestly?
Oh, geez. That was, well, I'm 43 and I've been wanting to make a comic book since I was like 12.
well, okay.
But you know, when you first get into it, there was like a good 8 to 9 months of me just figuring out, how am I going to do this? How am I going to create it? What program am I going to use? Should I use a program? I started off creating pages on Procreate on my iPad. Then I discovered Clip Studio and started using that.
You're a stylus digital pad user?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I do a lot of work on paper to physical medium too. Mm-hmm. It's just I can do a page half the time that it takes to do it on paper. I can do it on the Clip Studio. So I've adjusted to using pretty much all digital for the comic book to save time, really. It's just so much easier time-releasing wise,
Mm-hmm. And for the indie comic scene, what do you see generally holds people back from like having a successful campaign from what you observe throughout the years?
It's very lonely in indie comics.
You would expect, sounds like a marriage.
Yeah. You know, the analogy that I use sometimes is like, if you are going to open up a big hamburger stand in a food court filled with hamburger stands, you would think, okay, we're all making hamburgers. We've all know how difficult this is.
Yeah.
We all are going through the same problems and our own problems. You would think that there would be a camaraderie amongst everyone. And there really isn't. There is pockets and there is nice people and there's
like cliques here and there.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, one of the harder lessons you have to learn is that the only one that really cares about you getting your book done and you getting it created is you at the end of the day. So you have to really make sure your goals are right. I mean, this is a lot of work when you go to start doing interiors and you realize, well, shit, it's taking me 10 hours, 12 hours to do one page and you're on page 5 of 36. It's just like, what the hell am I doing? You know, at times.
Yeah.
So there's a point where you have to get where you're going to hit a wall. And then if you really want to do this, you'll push through that wall and you'll keep going. Like right now, there was a point where I stopped my original 56 pages that I did of Sig and Joe. Those are the first 56. I was putting them on Webtoons and I just stopped production and started all over again with the series.
Did you see any like traction on Webtoons? Because I've heard a lot of people do that too, where they'll create it digitally, put it up on Webtoons, and then see the initial response. Did that have any effect at all?
There was some. Like, I got up to 40 followers as I was putting out chapters.
Not too bad, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad. They were interactive. There were lots of comments.
Mm-hmm.
So that was cool. The problem with Webtoons is that if you're not going to meet their meta, which is color comics, slice of life, kind of manhwa style or anime style, if you're not going to do that, you're going to have a harder time because that is kind of like the meta of Webtoons.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're consistent, you have to be consistent. Like, I'm not going to go back to Webtoons or platforms like that until I have all 4 issues of Sig and Joe's arc done, because then I can release the chapters out on a schedule. Like every 2 weeks, a chapter hits.
Constant content flowing.
Yeah. They love that there. And then there's some viewers that will only start reading your series after it's done, or there's like 100 chapters out. So there's a whole kind of community there. The pros and cons of Webtoons is that you can build super fans there. Fans who will like do Patreons and follow you and want to do a graphic novel on a Kickstarter. So there is that there, but it's a very slow go of picking up fans, and you have to be super consistent and you have to have a certain kind of look to the book, and you know, there are there, but it is a grind, and you have to. Mm-hmm. I tell people, like, if you're gonna do it, have at least, you know, a full story arc done on your book, and then start releasing it, because then you don't have to, you know, you can be consistent. Don't try to do it like some of those guys where you're creating a page a week or a chapter. Well, some of those chapters like 20 pages worth, and they're doing it like once a week.
I don't know how manga artists do it. They're just built differently. These motherfuckers put out chapters a week. That's ridiculous.
Well, that is crazy. Health problems because of it too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Bleach, Taikubo, I mean, he was very, very open about all the problems that manga artists go through. And yeah, like the stories are great. I really enjoy a lot of anime. I love anime since I was a little kid, actually. But when I was reading all that stuff that he went through, and I was like, bro, I think someone did the calculations based on how popular he was, how rich he was. That means you would probably have 5 hours of free time a week, given how busy he was creating a chapter. People got a chapter, not a page, a chapter. So that means he's probably doing 5 pages a day to get those chapters done. That's ridiculous.
Because it's about 19 to 21 pages for a chapter in a Japanese manga release.
manga
got me back into comics. Like, I left comics for a while as a fan.
Which run? Do you remember which run or time period that was?
What was it? It was when Marvel started doing the big events every 6 months, where it's like, if you wanted to know what was going on.
Probably around 2016, 2017 has to be. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I'm not going to buy all these books to try to keep up. Like, I don't want to grab my Spider-Man comic and then to know what's going on, I have to read like 13 other series. And
that's my big problem now with them. It's good looks. I still buy new stuff. This is Ultimate Invasion trade paperback that they came out with a few months ago. Basically, now it's characters will have big events, and then there's like this 2-3 week-ish period where it's a little bit of a break.
Yeah,
and then it's a big event again. We just had Gang War. Gang War was already a thing in Spider-Man comics a long time ago. They had Gang War, which lasted like 48 issues. 2 week-ish break. Now we're in Blood Hunt. Blood Hunt lasts like 48 issues. And after that, we got to get another big event. DC the same way. Or like other characters will have like little mini events like Wolverine and Sabretooth. They're having a war right now. They're just like, first of all, this obsession with war is ridiculous. It's always a war with these characters. It's just like, it's just literally big event after big event after big event. Whereas DC, it's like literally a bunch of shit, average stuff at best, and then a big event randomly. They don't have a Justice League title right now on. It's Teen Titans that are the group right now, which is like, bro, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Like, I can see why people don't buy this stuff. It's like, then they do label the other subsequent issues that you may not be buying Blood Hunt or the event. But it's like, if I'm not into Moon Knight, I'm not buying Moon Knight's comics just to tie in something. I'm not doing that. You know?
Yes. I buy comics just based on the writing and an artist team sometimes. And I don't want to try to figure out what's going on just because I want to read like a Scott Snyder written book or along those lines. I wish they would stop doing that. I wish they would slow down, maybe not get rid of all of the titles, but like trim them up a bit and
start
creating some self-contained stories.
Or slim down the big events. Cause like big events are cool. I like big events. I do, but they feel more meaningful when I can work to get to them, you know?
Yeah. They should be cooking one for a year or two before they have the big event.
Yeah, and then, Blood Hunt.
Yeah,
in May. I guarantee you, they put Blood Hunt out in October. That might have been their best selling book in years. But no, they chose to do it in May. Fuck. Who makes these decisions? I have no idea.
It's vampires, like, guys, eggs like $20 now. Come on, buying 50 books right now.
Eggs for my kids or comic books? I'm choosing books. So this was your Kickstarter campaign, actually. The Adventures of Sig and Joe, issue number 1, part 1 of 4, the train heist arc right here. That's a nice little cool artwork there. It's a nice style there.
All right. I use a shade style, kind of cartoony look to my style. I have a lot of influence from manga, and I'm trying to get more action and energy in it. So there's the issue 3 looks a lot, well, not a lot different, but you can tell my growth by issue 3. And I use a gray wash style because I can't color because I'm colorblind. So,
oh really? I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. I'm colorblind. So there's certain ranges of color I can't see. So I can color stuff on my own, but when you want to talk about pro level, I can't do it. So I have to either pay somebody, which is hard to do. And then,
are you launching on other platforms actually?
I'm launching on this one, and then I'm probably going to go over to Indiegogo after I see how this one does. This is my first campaign ever, so it's been kind of a roller coaster getting everything ready. But I want to try Indie, and then I might try Fund Your Comic too, mm-hmm. and just see how they go on each market. No reason why not to, you know?
Yeah, no reason to not, you know, spread the wealth and go to different places, actually.
The campaign funded in the first 8 hours. I was very excited. It was a small goal, but I'm still very happy that it got funded in the first day.
Yeah, man. A lot of people, you know, would kill to have their campaigns funded in the first day, actually.
Yeah.
Good gosh. Okay. Nice little campaign here. This character right here, this is, reminds me of that one alien from Invincible, actually.
Yes, Alan.
Yeah.
Marv is a favorite of a lot of people who have read the series so far, mm-hmm. and he's a 3-foot-tall little stick of dynamite. Doesn't take crap from anybody.
Good lord, gonna be including any DEI in your book? Actually, you know, got to be inclusive.
I'm just happy that I'm doing.
I prefer to make money.
Yeah, I'm not really worried about it. Like, I don't worry about how Joe's anatomy works or Sig's anatomy works, and it's like, you know, what nationality are? Well, Sig's a Marlboro and Joe is a Folgers. You know, it's like, I'm just gonna keep it that way.
So I imagine it's been super exciting doing this. You know, I can't wait till you have the fully printed book in your hands. That's gonna feel pretty good.
Oh, actually. I've already done print runs on myself, self-financed. And
it came out beautiful. I tell
people that if you make a comic, even if you just do a 25 book run just for yourself, there is nothing like having that work in your hands the first time.
I imagine having it in your hands, like, it gives you even more inspiration to keep pushing.
Actually. Oh, it was a massive, huge boost for me to see this and to.
Oh, that's so cool! Moving. Oh shit!
Yeah, there's a lot of action, a lot of humor. Mm-hmm. In this book, a lot of good outright laughs. Mm-hmm. There's Marv not taking crap from anybody.
Good lord. I was gonna ask you about the story, just one little thing. So is it more of a story where it's like a one and done adventure of the week kind of thing in the first issue?
No, this is gonna be an ongoing. So this first arc is essentially a train heist arc. The first issues are them preparing for the heist, and then the last two issues is the heist itself. And mm-hmm. then the next arc will be the ramifications from that heist. And then mm-hmm. the next arc will move on their journey. And then, so I plan to do this for 50, you know, 60 issues, depending on how long it takes me to get to the finale. Cause sometimes, you know, issue one's 44 pages, issue two is 36, and then issue three is already 55. So
yeah.
Pages are all kind of over the place because I don't restrict for my writing. Yeah. So yeah, this is going to be an ongoing. I'm treating it like an ongoing series all the way to the. There is a set ending, but I'm going to move all the way to it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any other ideas for any other type of storytelling?
Oh yeah, I have one issue already done being lettered right now by my editor and letterer, Max Weston. It's called How the Realm Stood Still. And it is an anthropomorphic story about this, like, about a D&D style fantasy kingdom. It's a little mm-hmm. port city town, and their protector is a warrior knight named Stewie. And he's a cat with a big, huge berserk type sword. And, one night, him and his wizard apprentice sidekick are guarding the city when they get hit by a 1930s style War of the Worlds invasion. So it's going to be final swords and stones meets like this whole mm-hmm. this invading army from space. And so it's there. And I've got the issue one of that done, and I'm going to be working on issue two next year after I get Sig and Joe those four issues done. I'm putting everything on that first, because you get those four issues done, you can start shopping it to publishers, because publishers like having that first arc done. I also have a Santa Claus one shot, and there's some other stories bouncing around in my head right now.
Yeah. So you said publishers like the whole first arc done. The goal is to like put it in like maybe like a Barnes and Noble, hopefully, you know.
Or yeah, a Barnes and Noble library. Yeah. I have lines to possibly get it into Antarctic Press.
That's awesome.
And that'll get me into the comic book shops. I'm also, once I have the four issues done, and this is for, you know, with creators, if you get the first four issues done, you have a graphic novel. Graphic novels are easier sells for comic book shops and Barnes and Nobles because those places want a 50% markdown from the cover price. So if you want to sell that book for $15, Barnes and Noble wants it for $7.50 a piece. So that's much easier to work with independent margins if you have a graphic novel. So there is perks to having that graphic novel together when you're going to look at doing sales. So yeah, that's my plan, is to get those four issues done so I can have a graphic novel. Publishers like having arcs done, so then that way, once they start release, they won't have any breaks. Like issue one comes out this year, issue two might come out 3 years from now. They hate that stuff. So
It's also the consumer. It, for me, when I'm getting like trades, cause I'm doing my comic book channel, you know, I told people for current issues, I would have to buy those monthly, cause that's till like the arc ends or whatever. But if it's for anything older that I know that I don't have to buy monthly, I'm just going to buy it in trade. Cause it's just not worth investing in all those issues and stuff like that. Just if Batman Beyond, for example, guys, for Batman Beyond, I could just go buy all the Batman Beyond trades for any arc that he's on altogether, not one at a time, you know, it's just way easier, you know?
Yeah, I agree. When it's, I do the same thing. Now there is an entire collector market for those floppies because there's no collector value at all in graphic novels, but there is the collector market in floppies. So if you're going to be in my philosophy is that I want to sell to everybody. So I make floppies, sell to collectors. I make graphic novels to sell to readers. I'll make a digital to sell to people who like digital. Like if you, whatever way you want this, I'll try to make it that way and try to get it to that part of the market.
And digital is good for people that, you know, can't afford to pay for shipping and all that stuff, you know? So that way they at least have access to the story. I know people rag on digital a lot, but digital does have a nice place in the market. It just does, you know, having just access of reading and getting it is super valuable, you know? Sometimes even more than money, because you might get a long-time reader and purchaser after that, and then that's another customer you have, you know?
Yeah, I still do. If it's an unproven Kickstarter, and I don't know for sure if I'm going to like it, I'll get the digital. And then when issue two's Kickstarter comes out, I'm going to buy issue one and issue two, do a catch-up. The problem with digital that some people have, and the big argument is... If you spend $6,000 to make your comic book, you need the most per customer that you can get. So guys that have had 300 customers, pledgers on their Kickstarter, and let's say 80% of those bought a physical book. Well, let's say times get rough. Now 50% of them buy a digital book instead of buying the physical. Now your overall head margin has drastically dropped because they're buying the $5 digital instead of the $25 physical. So it hurts a lot of guys who have a large overhead in the Kickstarter world, because it has been seen a lot more digital in some areas start picking up for creators. Since I am a creator artist, I don't have any overhead except for, well, there is some overhead when I pay for a colorist for my covers and I get commissioned work. But my overhead's just really, really low. So yeah, you want to buy a digital, go right ahead. That's money right to my pocket. I've already beat my spread, so you guys are good. But when if you're trying to make sure that you get at least $6,000 in order to make the next one, then that's huge, concerning when people start doing that. Yeah.
And the last few things I'll ask you is, got any big plans for yourself coming up this year in 2024 outside of, or sorry, including with this as well?
It's just right. My journey has turned into learning how to market myself. So I'm trying to learn how to become more consistent online. And a lot of my goals set for this year is to get myself out there more, to build up an audience and a following, not to be such a hideaway and not talk to, you know, it's like, it's time to get out, time to sell. I have my first convention is coming up in August.
That's awesome.
The local people are putting together an alien convention, it's like a Area 51 type. And I got a table there. I'm making a special 17-page comic just for that. I'm going to be selling my comic there, and it's the first time I ever had a table, so I'm excited about that. And it's just trying to get myself out there more and build up the weakest part of my business right now, which is marketing and monetization. So I spent a lot of time on the creative. Now it's figuring out how do you sell yourself? How do you get out there?
Yeah. And the last thing I'll ask is there any special shout out you want to give to anyone in particular and anything else you want to say before we head out?
I'd love to give a shout out to my business partner and my best friend, Max Weston. He does my editing and my lettering, but he also is a huge support. We talk about stories. He's a writer himself. He has two comic books that he's working on getting out. Welcome to Blue Water and Wavelight. So I'd like to give a shout out to him, to Pete Vasquez, Phil Leon, Larry Higgins, Max DeVille, Sam Quentin, all you guys, love you. And all my supporters, thank you guys so much. And thank you for having me on this awesome show and for this great conversation. I had a blast.
Anytime, man. Yeah. Oh, I'd love to have you on again. Come around, like, you know, the time where you, after you have your first convention, you know, it'd be great to have another catch up. Like, hey, Dad, I came back from my first convention. Here's our cold beer. Let's talk.
Let's talk about this. It's so much fun.
All right, everyone. Thank you guys for checking out this episode of the Iron Man podcast, and we'll see you guys in the next one. Goodbye, everyone.